Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 26, 2004. Today's session number is CAM 2004-01. Today's speakers are Mary Carlson and Dan Spencer. The lesson for today is Bioethics as Vocation, Our Bodies, Our Faith, Introduction to Christian Ethical Decision Making. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Well, welcome everybody. Thank you for keeping the two fire aisles here. Don't pull anybody, put chairs in there. So, we're glad you're here, and since I started, I'll start. My name is Mary Carlson, and I have been at Holden a number of times in my life. The longest is only a month, so I've never been long-term staff, but I feel like one of the older timers here, and it's a delightful feeling to come back each time I do. I teach social work at St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and do that after a number of years being a medical social worker in a number of healthcare settings, hospice, long-term care, and acute care settings. So I come to today's topic with a fair amount of professional experience and some degree of knowledge of ethics, because a number of us in the faculty at St. Olaf were invited to participate in a two-year Bush Foundation grant to try to prepare more of us to teach undergraduate ethics courses because we didn't have enough ethicists on the faculty. So I had a sort of crash course for 2 years with a couple of theologians and ethicists from the faculty, preparing a number of us to incorporate ethics throughout our own curriculum. So while I'm no expert in ethics, I have had some background there, I am more the expert in the bedside realities of human life in medical situations.
Now, part of the thing we want to talk about, my name is Dan Spencer, by the way, I'll tell you a little bit more about me, but Mary and I both operate on the assumption is that each of us are the experts in our own lives, that we all do ethics all the time, and part of the wonderful joys, privileges, and responsibilities of being a Christian community is finding ways to think ethically and act ethically together. And so that's part of what we're going to be doing this week. Mary mentioned we feel a little bit like old timers. One of the ways we do, we've taught here before. We both graduated to reading glasses since the last time we taught together, so we're still trying to be able to read our own notes, and we'll ask your patience as we do that. I was on the faculty at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa for 10 years in the philosophy and religion department, where I focus primarily on ethics. I currently teach at the University of Montana in Missoula. I continue to work on ethical issues, but a variety of things as well. Yeah, please feel free to fill in up there. We'll make sure we get the case studies up there as well. Do you want me just to mention a little bit about the week? Or? What we're going to be doing today is really introducing what is ethics in general, what is Christian ethics, and what is biomedical ethics, so that we can give some background conversation, some familiarity with some of the vocabulary. We're going to introduce a method that we're going to use together to focus on case studies for the rest of the week together. So the following four sessions will be much more interactive. We'll try to make this one interactive as well, but we're going to have each of the four sessions focus on specific cases that highlight specific issues in ethics this week. Today, try and give you some of the background information on that. Each one of these sessions is designed to stand alone, and so if you know people who didn't make it here today but want to come the rest of the week, that's perfectly fine. We'll review the essentials of the method each time we get started. We've got some newsprint sheets. We'll focus on that.
One of the things I said to Dan is it's important as we go through to think about the theme for the summer and to set that context a little bit for our series, and we'll both stand up most of the time, so I hope we're projecting enough for everybody, is to think about our goal as teachers this week to help summon out what we all shall be in a community of believers and searchers, but to look at how, in addition, we will behave or act in specific kinds of situations that will face all of us, whether it's professionally or personally. All of us will be called upon to vote for people who believe in certain things, for policies related to end-of-life care. Some of us have already had experience with this, which we'll get into over the week. Some of us professionally work in healthcare settings. So we're really looking at how we can be the best, most ethical actors in light of our community of faith as Christians or people on the search for where we are. And I got some helpful context for this in a book, one of the books that I recommended for the week, which is Doug Scurman's book on vocation. It's just come out, thanks to a Lilly Fellows grant. It's in the bookstore. And he does a nice job for lay people in discussing vocation from various religious traditions, and talks about the notion of general calling, that is the calling for all of us to turn to Christ and become believers, and what all is involved there, and then particular or locations as callings, people working in our own lives, in our own contexts, to live out what we're supposed to be and do in our lives as people of God. So that's very helpful, and I encourage you at least to read the first couple chapters of Doug's book. It's helpful for us here.
Let me mention one thing here, and then we're Mary and I are going to try to keep each other on track in terms of the time here. In some of the teaching I've been doing in Montana, I've been really having fun teaching Greek tragedies. And one of the things that Greeks were really, really attuned to was what emerged as the notion of a moral tragedy. A moral tragedy is any time you look back and think, if I'd only thought things through, I would have acted differently and could have prevented something bad or something tragic from happening. And the Greeks were really adept at thinking of all sorts of amazing scenarios to illustrate that. But that's a lot of what we're about this week here. Tragic elements are unavoidable in our lives. There is a tragic dimension to life. But one of the joys and the helpful things about Christian community is that we can talk to each other and practice ethical scenarios so that when we inevitably confront those difficult parts of our lives, we've thought through them through and as much as possible can work together to avoid moral tragedies. And so this is going to be a week of practicing Christian community, the vocation of thinking thoughtfully and ethically together in light of our faith. And what I want to do is start, and Mary's going to just jot some notes on the board of this. I mentioned before, we see you all as the experts of your own lives. We all are acting ethically in lots of different ways. But sometimes the words get in the way. So I wanted to get them out right at the beginning here. When you hear the terms ethics or ethical, what comes to mind? Ethics or ethical? Decisions, okay? Decisions.
Doing what is right.
Right versus wrong is a key category here. Matthew.
I was thinking
Stem cell research. That's a critical issue that's on the agenda right now. We're going to take a look at that later in the week as it relates to at least a couple of different ethical issues. So stem cell research, there are a lot of contemporary issues out there right now. Good. Other things, ethics or ethical?
Dilemmas.
We're often, somebody here needs the need to act. Somebody has dilemmas that force us to make choices and decisions.
Situational ethics.
Say more about situational ethics.
Sometimes what seems right depends upon many factors at that time, and it may not be the same thing you want to do under different circumstances.
This is a very important current debate. Are there absolute moral rules and guidelines that are applicable regardless of the situation or the context, or does our situation context supply important, if not critical, dimensions to help guide our decision on that? And we'll get a chance to think about those issues when we look at some of the cases here. So situation versus absolute rules. And folks, if you're up in the balcony, I'm not seeing you, be assertive here. Anything else?
Restraint of behavior to prevent harm or guiding your, have some sort of way to conduct yourself so that you don't do harm.
There's a couple of key things that you mentioned there. One is restraints on our behavior. Ethics is really critical because it sets limits for the ways that we can act. And how do we guide what should shape some of those limits? At least one of them is to avoid doing harm. We'll see, particularly in the biomedical field, the whole notion of what emerges as non-maleficence. First of all, do no harm. It's a basic guideline there, but that notion of voluntarily setting limits on our behavior is a really critical one. And of course, within the Christian field of ethics, there's all sorts of different guidelines for what kinds of limits we should do and why, as there are in all other religious dimensions and secular ethics.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Judgment.
Judgment. Say more about judgment.
Well, if I'm right and you're wrong, that's judgment.
Okay. We've seen the several things. The need to act, facing dilemmas, putting restraints, and that calls for critical judgment. And ethics can sometimes feel like a relativistic free-for-all. That's your opinion, this is my opinion, there's no way to get past that. What Mary and I are going to try to argue this week and introduce is a way to get past simple relativism. We look at some guidelines that most of us can agree on, that in turn can shape our conversation together.
Hence the underline of critical. That's about a thoughtful process and not a knee-jerk response.
Now let me shift to another couple of terms here. When we're talking about ethics and ethical, we oftentimes talk about morals or morality, which are very much related. But if I would put out the terms morals or morality in terms of what they bring up for you, what are some of the thoughts come out of that?
Foundation.
Say more about that.
If you come up to a decision in your life, you think back to the foundation that was given to you by your church or your parents or whoever. And that kind of will help you make that.
It's an excellent image. It's an image of the notion of a foundation, because all of us come out of different kinds of foundational systems. We come out of family systems, cultural systems, religious systems, political systems. And they provide us with guidelines so that we don't have to start from scratch. So we oftentimes return to those foundations there. Yeah.
And again, that's part of our hope, that you leave just today, or at the end of the week, or at the end of two sessions of ours, with a clearer sense of your own foundations for making choices about ethical behavior.
So when we talk about a moral foundation, as opposed to, say, a legal foundation or a cultural foundation, what's a moral foundation? What makes it moral?
Faith guidance.
Faith guidance? Certainly a critical part of it, faith guidance. But there's other things that we do that involve faith that aren't necessarily involving morality. When we're talking about a moral foundation, a moral system, what are we implying?
Something about behavior.
Something about behavior?
Personal behavior.
Personal behavior can be personal, it can be community.
Values.
Okay, should. Now when you say a should, what does a should imply?
Well, the opposite of a should not.
All right. And what we're getting at here is morality and moral foundations imply judgments about right versus wrong, or better versus worse choices. And that implies that there are some kinds of standards or values or principles that we could use to guide us in that area. And so we want to be talking about that. But the other thing I want to really stress right at the beginning here, and Mary, you're going to keep me on track with your watch.
I'll try.
Mary and I are both somewhat extroverted, so we have a tendency to get carried away with these wonderful conversations. One of the things that's critical, we talk about morality usually associated with human beings. We don't really talk about moral behavior of deer, or cats, or insects. It would be lovely if we could hold mosquitoes accountable in the world. And one of the reasons is morality involves the ability to make choices. We've seen several people here have done that before, but that's a critical component. Our ability to take in information, think about it, have values, and make choices on that. And that's something that, as far as we know, is relatively distinct to human beings. There does seem to be some limited moral behavior in some other animals, in some of the primates and whales, dolphins, and so forth. But in terms of a conscious reflective system, it seems to be unique to human beings. Most animals are guided primarily by instinct. And while instinct and biological influences are very important to human behavior, so is this notion of intentional choice here. One of the things that happens as we begin to make choices about our behavior and actions is we create patterns of choices and actions there. And those patterns develop into what we call character. We can talk about the character of individuals or the character of communities that are expressed by the kinds of choices, the kinds of patterns that communities make. So we can talk about a compassionate community, a ruthless community, a violent individual, a thoughtful individual, and these are the character is expressed through the choices they make and the patterns that emerge on that. And so we want to keep this interplay in mind through the week here, particularly because we're talking about Christian ethical reflection. The ethics is simultaneously about the way we act and about who we are. That is, our individual choices and actions and our patterns or our character. And it's about the character and actions of individuals and the character and actions of communities and how those play together there. So if I have a short little definition of ethics, we have a common terms in ethics over here which we'll make some reference to. But most simply, I would say ethics is about who we are and how we act in light of who we say we want to be and how we say we want to act. Now, for Christians, that means there's something about being Christian individuals and Christian community that shapes who we are and how we act in there. But ethics is simply about who we are, how we act, in light of who we say we want to be, how we want to act. All right. I got 5 minutes? Or... All right. Let me just mention a couple of more things here, and then I'm going to have Mary introduce this more specifically to the biomedical ethics, which is going to be our primary focus within ethics this week. What do Christians bring to the table of Christian ethical decision-making? We've had several people mention some different things here. I would say what makes Christian ethical decision-making distinctive is our relationship to a tradition that's centered around a notion of gospel. This notion of good news, that God's proclamation of good news that somehow reorients our identity and our lives around that there. The gospel includes Scripture as an authoritative source of that. But Scripture is not the only source. There are other ways that we understand and see the gospel expressed in our lives here. And much of the history of Christian ethics has revolved around 4 primary elements. And it's the way Christian communities combine these elements that gives them their distinctive flavor. So here I'm going to borrow from our Wesleyan friends in the Methodist tradition. John Wesley talked about the Wesleyan quadrilateral or four-sided approach to ethics here, and I think it has a lot of really good guidance for us. We understand gospel. I'm going to put gospel and ethics in the center here as being informed by at least 4 distinct sources. One of them is Scripture. Christians believe that Scripture is an authoritative witness to the good news, to the gospel, that it's still applicable in our lives. We can look to it to inform how we should think about things. But we also think we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We have 2,000 years of Christian witness to how Scripture has informed minds. And so when we look at the field of ethics, theology, we oftentimes look at tradition, Christian tradition. We ask ourselves, what's the witness of those who have gone before us? And what do they tell us about this? And so both Scripture and tradition take the expression of the gospel in our human history and bring that witness to us today. Christians make a further claim, though, that the gospel, that the Spirit is active not only in the past, not only in the pulling together of the Bible, not only in those who've gone before us, but the Spirit is active among us today. And we see that ethicists see this in 2 additional sources. A third area is our own experience. We believe we can look to our own experience, guided by the witness of Scripture and tradition, to discern the Spirit, to discern the gospel. And we also believe that God has given us a particular tool that helps us to do this. And that is our ability to reason or to think thoughtfully. And so these 4 elements are oftentimes combined by different Christian communities as we think about this. Now, my own tradition, the United Church of Christ, coming out of the congregational tradition, puts a lot of emphasis on experience. Really believes that our experience really shows us a lot of this. If I were coming to you out of, say, the Assemblies of God, or the Four Square tradition, what do you think would be the primary source? Scripture. You know, particularly the more fundamentalist ones will have a particular way of reading this, but it's the combination. Virtually all of them have some way of combining these. And so we want to keep these in mind as we go through our thinking about Christian ethical decision-making here. Do you want to add anything?
I'd like to just point out that Wesley underlined the primacy of Scripture in his quadrilateral.
And most Christian traditions have. Most Christian traditions have said that the Scripture is really critical to how we do this. The question then emerges, how do we read Scripture? How do we apply it? And that's where the other 3 come in really, really central. For example, I grew up Roman Catholic. In the Roman Catholic tradition, you read Scripture largely through canon law, largely what the Church has said about it. So the role of tradition in the Catholic Church is extremely important for how you read Scripture. There are others, if you're a Pentecostal, you read Scripture largely through your own experience of the Spirit. There is a strongly experiential dimension. Unitarians, strong emphasis on reason. So it's the way these other sources come in there, and that's oftentimes where Christians fight about. Now, what's the best way to combine these? At this point, I simply want to lift them up because they're all going to enter into our conversation. And I would mention one thing. The fundamental premise or assumption is that God speaks through all four of these. That the Spirit is present with the good news, how we should be and act through Scripture, through the witness of those who've gone before, through our own experience, through our ability to reason and think together. So that's all I'm going to say at this point about Christian ethical decision making. We want to shift now into this notion about what about bioethics, this interesting combination here, and I'm going to have Mary talk a little bit about that.
I think it is probably better if I stand up. And if Spence and I had a month, we could do a sort of ethics. And I love teaching with Dan because he's such an expert in many things, and you can tell when he talks. But we decided to focus on bioethics instead of environmental ethics, or perhaps more narrowly, professional ethics. You could go into other sorts of ethics, partly because we think this is a place where virtually everybody in the room will have some experience, as I mentioned earlier. So what is bioethics? It is how we want to act, how we think about our actions and our beings in light of our lives, biologically in particular. And we're focusing this week primarily on end-of-life case studies and end-of-life discussions that involve ethical decision-making and ethical dilemmas. Again, because we only have a week, and that's big enough. But we are talking about life and the body, hence our title, Our Bodies, Our Faith, as part of what we're going to talk about doing. Now, in bioethics, we are making an assumption, as do most bioethicists, that there are some decisions that can be made based on principles that are more right than other sorts of principles, so that, as we mentioned earlier, we're not into a free-for-all about if you think this is okay and I disagree, then we're happy that way. But really, there are some ways to think about making decisions in very difficult situations, and we can make arguments that are reasoned about that based on our own tradition, scripture, experience, and in some of these cases, medical knowledge, social knowledge, psychological knowledge as well. These glasses are going to drive me crazy. So we really are saying there are some standards against which we can make decisions, and we'll be wrestling with some of those sorts of decisions as we go through the week. In bioethics, there is a key question always underlying bioethics, and that is, who makes these decisions? In our country in particular, we have great conversation about this. Is it the physician? Unlike Britain, where I spent the last year living in London, the physicians make all the decisions. In our country, we say no. It's the patient. Oh, maybe it's the family, depending on one's cultural point of view. Perhaps it's the tribe. Perhaps it's an elder. Perhaps it's public policymakers. And with several of our case studies this week, we will move from individual situations into political and public policy ramifications. One of my favorite, sort of a nasty way to put it, dead white sociologist, C. Wright Mills, would write about private issues, private concerns and public issues, that in many situations, what for a period of history we thought was a private concern, for instance, violence within the family, has, because of a number of influences in the 70s and 80s, become much more of a public concern. Abortion, for some and for a long time, perhaps considered a private concern, has become now a public issue. So that much of what's underlying public policy began as perhaps even one case, as we'll see in some of the things we cover this week. So historically, bioethics has really been with us primarily about the last 35 years or so. Why is that? Why is it such a new subset of ethics?
Technology.
It's sort of the one word answer. We now can do things to keep the body going, to treat the body, to address bodily concerns that we had no concept of in the 50s and the 40s of the last century, let alone before that. So many of our parents and grandparents sort of shake their heads at the kinds of things we have to think about now and perhaps prepare for. So it really is a recent phenomenon to have to talk about bioethics. 100 years ago, how did most people in our country die? Old age. And what did they die of in old age? We don't just die because we're old. What happened to most of them?
Disease.
Pneumonia. The specific disease of pneumonia called the old man's, old person's, friend. People died of pneumonia. Pneumonia wasn't treated. And one of our first case study, we'll talk about that too. That isn't true anymore. Somewhere between 80 and 90% of us in this room will die what Daniel Callahan at the Hastings Center calls a managed death. What does that mean? Other people are managing what happens to us, and most of that will be done in a setting that isn't our home and isn't out on the highway to car accident. So it behooves us all to think about what bioethics is about. That's right. So it has been an arena of ethics that's come really to the forefront with primarily physicians and nurses in the medical setting, lawyers, as we're trying to distinguish what's legal and what's ethical. The general public was having more and more of a voice, particularly, as I say, in our country here. And theologians and philosophers have all had conversation about this. Medical technology has sort of pushed us in this country, and I think it's safe to say Dan and I would agree that technology, in a way, has pushed further ahead than our ethical reflection about technology. And we have this sort of thinking in general, which I think is rather flawed, that if we can do it, then we should do it. And ethics is about the should. We have a lot of capacity and opportunity and possibility. Does that mean we should use it, and under what circumstances? So that's really what we're about. Okay, so let's go to some of the principles that underlie bioethics in particular.
We got some newsprint sheets which are going to be hard for some of you to see, but we'll be making a lot of reference to them, and we'll try to keep repeating.
And we'll have them up for each one. Have no fear, we're not going to go through all of these, but all these principles are helpful in bioethics. But there are several that are the basic ones which will underlie our cases throughout the week, and which are terms we would like you to leave here using in your regular vocabulary. That's one of our goals. So that this doesn't feel like something other people do, but it's something we can do in our churches and in nursing homes, etc. The first and sort of fundamental principle underlying bioethics, at least in our Western, and I would say actually in all contexts, but Christianity puts a very strong focus on this, is the notion of respect for persons. And that is the human life has value in and of itself, called intrinsic value. And that means, generally speaking, we ought not use human beings for other ends, but they are ends in themselves, the intrinsic value, respect for persons. That becomes very important when we have arguments about the sanctity of a person's life, their life, and what quality of life that is. And those will become important as we talk. So that really, for most of us, is the primary principle where we start. Because we are children of God, created in God's image, we have worth in and of ourselves. So respect for persons is the first one.
And Mary and I are going to simply assume respect for persons for much of what we talk about here, but that will not answer all the questions, because as Mary mentioned, under respect for persons is respect both for the sanctity or the dignity of their life, but also for the quality of their life. One of the things that modern medical technology has done is it created the capacity to keep bodies functioning almost indefinitely, but oftentimes a tremendous sacrifice for what the person themselves experiences, the quality of that life. And so it raises that question, if the quality of life becomes so impaired, have you undermined the respect for the dignity of that life? Or does the sanctity of life itself require you to intervene at all costs to keep the person living, their sanctity? So we'll see that there are going to be tensions between this quality and sanctity of life. In most situations, they cohere. They come together. Quality of life and sanctity of life come together. We'll see in some places where they're really challenged that. Now, in the Western tradition, we're going to be focusing a lot within the Western tradition on Christianity. But the other branch of our Western moral tradition has been the Greco-Roman or the Hellenistic tradition, going back to Greece and Rome. And a particular physician named Hippocrates, where we get the, not the hypocritical oath, as my students sometimes said, but the Hippocratic oath. And Hippocrates was a physician who gathered together several other physicians and said, how should we practice morally medicine? And the very first law that Hippocrates said was our duty, primary duty is whatever else, do no harm. You may not intentionally harm one of your patients. Most of us, well, in fact, I would say probably all of us, simply take that for granted today. When you go to a healthcare situation, you probably don't even think consciously, I wonder if this person's going to intentionally harm me. Okay? I pay my money, and no, because we do, this is a basic ground rule. So we call this non-maleficence, do not harm. But it's going to raise some very interesting issues. The issue is usually do not intentionally harm. What about abortion, where fetal life is destroyed? What about assisted suicide, where in the name of quality of life concerns, you have physicians being asked to help end the life? There are lots of other things about, is that ruled out by non-maleficence? What does harm mean? Is it more harmful to keep a person alive in great pain rather than letting them end their life there? Is that harmful? So how, what is this actually circumscribed in terms of behavior? But it's a critical one that we has grounded Western bioethics and morality for centuries. The converse, or the flip side of non-maleficence, is a principle we call beneficence. Not only do healthcare providers have a duty not to harm you, they have a positive duty to promote your well-being, to help you improve, if at all possible. Now, when Mary and I teach together, we often emphasize this as promote your whole well-being. There was a tendency for a while, particularly before the rise of a lot of patient autonomy, to see this as promote your physical well-being, to make you better. And we still sort of have that sense. When you go to the doctor's office, you expect to get a prescription, something that's going to make you physically better. But we become much more sensitized that people are not compartmentalized. We can't separate our physical part out from our emotional, our mental, our spiritual. And so the duty of beneficence now is to act in ways that promote your whole well-being. And largely, how is that determined? By what you, the patient or the individual, thinks that means. And so we see a lot more integrative, holistic approaches to health now based on that. So we'll see non-maleficence and beneficence are really critical foundations for this here. Of these 2 through 5 are going to be kind of the basic 4 principles involved.
About those two is these assume then a duty to minimize potential harm and maximize possible good. So what you'll probably come out remembering is do not harm and do good, not non-maleficence and beneficence, but do not harm and do good. But that means minimize potential harm and maximize potential good as well among those. So then my favorite, because I'm a social worker, and one of our mantras in social work is client self-determination. The person decides what he or she wants in the course of the engagement with a social worker. We're not unusual. It's the mantra of our entire society, isn't it? It's up to me. I get to decide. We are a rights-based society, and underlying that is this notion of autonomy. The idea that we are responsible for ourselves. Auto refers to self. This has several sort of related, what's the philosophical term? Not caveats, but related something.
Corollaries.
Corollaries. Thank you. Related corollaries. And those are the right to choose, as I mentioned. If I have several choices in front of me, given by the physician or somebody else, it's my right to decide. Right to choose is one corollary. Self-determination. But under that, we have to know some more things. We have to say, well, on what basis might I choose? I have to know what I'm talking about. That means I have to give consent to something done to me to minimize harm or maximize benefit that is informed, meaning I have to understand it. I have to get the pros and cons, the possibilities. And that means if I have lower IQ, perhaps, or English is not my first language, or I don't understand non-maleficence, that somebody talks with me in a way that I am informed before I choose. That has a lot of ramifications in bioethics. Next, related to that is decision-making capacity. The lay term for this is competence. Is that person competent to decide what she wants in this situation? We try to not use that term anymore because it's too gray and vague. I mean, who decides who's competent in what? Some of us are competent in some areas of our lives and not in others, right? Here in medical ethics, bioethics, we talk about whether someone has the capacity to make a decision in this situation. And we'll get into that a little more when we talk about physician-assisted suicide and some of the other situations. And then is surrogacy. If a person does not have the capacity to make a decision, then somebody else needs to. And who is that? And bioethics has a clear way to talk about who is responsible for making decisions for somebody else. For children, it is parents. And that's perfectly clear, isn't it? Except when a child is 16, 15, 17, gets a little gray, doesn't it? Okay, how about the person who has a developmental disability? That means from birth, perhaps, a disability. Therefore, can't make an informed choice. Who's responsible? The guardian. Could be the parent. Could be somebody else that has come in with a state or a legal sort of understanding. So that is about who gets to decide. And under that, we have some other things to think about that we'll just briefly bring up. One is, on what basis do we decide? Do I decide for my developmentally disabled brother, if I'm the guardian, based on what I would want? Or based on what my brother would want? Well, what would he would want is called substituted judgment. I substitute my judgment for him. In other words, I make a decision that he would want. What if I don't ever know that? What if there's no way to know? Then I make a decision based on his best interests. So it's those two. Substitute judgment. She always said this is what she wanted, even though she can't decide now in her state of advanced Alzheimer's disease. I know that's what she said. That's substituted judgment. If it's not what I want, but it's what she would want. If I don't know, then it's on the best interest. Well, I think this would be best in light of having no idea what he would want. Okay, so those come up.
Maybe just a comment too while you're on this point here. And here is where you can oftentimes see the trickiness of other areas of social policy. Who decides for a spouse? The other spouse, if that's you're legally married. What about gay and lesbian spouses? We have all sorts of situations in this country, since gay and lesbian people don't get our relationships recognized, where biological family intervenes, courts intervenes, other than that. So just footnote that there. Sometimes these standards seem very clear, but they involve lots of other areas of social policy oftentimes. Or what about when society decides the parents aren't acting in the best interest of a child? Blood transfusions for Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, we'll be looking at some of these things. So we have some fairly clear guidances, but there's all sorts of areas.
Choir. Whoever wants to be in choir, we're not that. We need choir.
You won't hold it against you ethically if
no.
You want to go see.
Other gifts. One last and my favorite is, how about the 60-year-old single, never been married person who's not in a primary relationship? Who decides for that person if she can't decide? Sometimes the 90-year-old mother in the nursing home.
If
there is a 90-year-old mother in a nursing home who can, wants to, is able to decide. Yeah. Okay, last one you're going to? Okay. Yeah.
Well, and we've got a bunch of these up here. Mary and I both worked with a framework that was largely put together by folks at Georgetown University. And these, you'll sometimes hear these four, non-malepsence, beneficence, autonomy, and justice, as being the four sort of foundations, these others coming along here. But one of the things, and this is particularly important, I think, coming out of the Christian faith community, whatever, we believe that our God is a God of justice, that God acts in such ways and calls us to act in such ways that incarnate justice in our actions there. There's a lot of debate about what that means. Do we err on the side of equity, equality? Err on the side of reciprocity, mutuality? A variety of different ways to understand what this means. But the fundamental thing is that whatever we decide, there should be an element of justice that informs our decision-making here. In biomedical ethics, it means that only relevant criteria are taken into consideration for making decisions about things. So, for example, we tend to say that income level is not a relevant criteria. At the ethical level, now, policy level may be something completely different. We say skin color, we say age, these different kinds of things. There may be some situations where they're relevant, where, for example, race or age may have a relevant medical effect on medical condition. But in most situations, we use fairness, equality, and so forth as a fundamental principle. You treat equal people equally in terms of these different situations and don't discriminate based on non-relevant moral considerations.
And then utility.
Yes, and I would say that from these, then, there are several other things that flow. We'll be talking about some of these here. confidentiality, it flows out of respect for persons. You have a right that the information that's basic to you remains confidential unless you grant a release for that. Or, we'll see this sometimes extenuating circumstances. Same thing, honesty. You have a right to expect your healthcare provider to be honest with you, not to intentionally deceive you. Fidelity, don't betray trust. Once you enter into a relationship with a healthcare provider, you have a right to expect that they'll be faithful to that and not betray your trust. So these are subsidiaries that will come into there. But a really critical one that is very challenging we'll look at is the notion of utility. John Stuart Mill is the great sort of philosopher of utilitarianism. And it's most simple things. We act to bring about the greatest good for the greatest number of people. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. Utility is particularly important for those who set policy. We send our people in the legislature, to Congress, and so forth, with this belief that they're going to act in ways that maximize the greatest good for the greatest number of people. But we'll see, there are some times when utility conflicts strongly with some of the others here, with autonomy, with some of these other things here. So what do we do in those situations?
And utility doesn't matter except in a situation of scarce resources.
Right.
Right? We had all the money and all the organs and all the compassion and all the justice in the world, we wouldn't need to talk about utility. But we live in a society that distributes resources in different ways, and generally, probably always, those resources are scarce. Okay. As we said, this is more lecture than we'll do all week.
Let's pause though. Just a couple minutes here. Right. Any questions? Because thoughts. We really have practiced trying to get through this one here, but we want to make sure people come along with us. Yeah.
Would you expand a little bit on the differences or similarities of ethical and moral?
Ethical, I would say, is a broader category. And it has to do with notions of right and wrong. And ethics is a systematic or a very thorough look at that. And so you can see, you try to make cases based on principles, try to understand the broad scheme. There are several different realms of different kinds of ethical theory. We're dealing with a branch that's called normative ethics. That is, that there are beliefs that are right and wrong. There are some other branches within that. Morality is a little bit more focused in on personal or community notions of right and wrong, what counts as good or bad behavior. You can look between lots of different cultures and systems within that. They're very closely linked. But at least in my training, ethics is a broader category that brings in lots of other kind of concepts about how we do a sustained examination or study of that, and then make a principled case for particular ways of thinking about things or acting. That probably didn't help very much.
No, it does. Okay. I get the notion of ethics then as more of an instrument of examining someone's behavior or thoughts or whatever, rather than a fixed base. I mean, the Ten Commandments comes more under the heading of this is your moral code.
Yeah.
And
I give you an example. You, an ethicist, or you, in someone who takes looks at anthropology, to say, let's examine the ethics of the Third Reich.
Yeah.
Right? We can try to understand what are the principles, what are the assumptions, what are the values that went into that system. Now, we could then sit back and say, was that a moral system? We would evaluate the morality of that ethical system with some very specific criteria about right and wrong and so forth. But you get ethics really, is a cross-cultural kind of systematic way to look at things.
Systematic examination.
Yeah.
Systematic framework to examine.
Yeah.
That's how I think about it when I try to distinguish it.
Yeah. We've got it distinguished up here as morality deals with choices and behaviors which societies or cultures determine right or wrong. Ethics then is the systematic formulation of the moral principles, rules, and standards that express that.
So the question,
we're sort of slipping off the true meaning of ethics when we say what he did was unethical. We really are saying it's immoral.
Immoral, yeah. And people, and well, as I say, the terms get used interchangeably.
But that kind of depends on what his action was. If he murdered, that might be a moral issue. If he lied, if he lied to the prosecutor, that might be an unethical issue. Or if he had stepped across the bounds of the federal government's regulations on hiring government contractors, that might be an ethical issue.
And if ethics is a system, to say something is unethical means you've gone beyond the bounds of that system. Okay.
That's right, exactly. That's right. Beyond the bounds of that that's systematic. Right.
And then made a moral statement about it based on your own ground. And
so if you were looking at different ethical systems, one may be ethical behavior and one would be unethical in another, and depending on what the standards are.
So between these two definitions, there's this potential chasm for all kinds of healthy argument and debate and unhealthy argument and debate. And Christian decision-making and anti-Christian decision-making, because of the conflict that will arise from time to time between morality and ethics.
This is one of the issues that makes it very difficult in the international realm. I think it's why it's really important to have an adjective in front of your ethics. We're talking in this case about Christian ethics or Western ethics. But for example, Mary talked about in our Western society, we hold a great deal of weight for autonomy. We respect the right of individuals. There are many cultures in the world where that's simply not the fundamental one. So if you go to China, China doesn't make decisions based on what's moral or right in their country based on the fundamental of the individual. They look at the greater whole well-being of the society. And this is where you get international conflicts, respect for human rights versus sustainable population growth kinds of things. And so it becomes important to be clarifying what are our values and why, and that's where all the debate is going in here. Mary and I, what we try to do is present what is sort of a Western consensus, but this would not travel necessarily. My mother's a physician. When she lectured in China, very different sense of medical ethics. The issues that we agonize over here in terms of, for example, survivability of impaired infants simply weren't issues in China. If you're allowed one child, that child's born with spina bifida, it's just no question that child is not going to survive. You know, they don't have the resources to support it. The family doesn't want that to be their one child. I mean, it's just a very different framework. So we're going to prevent, you know, but what we want to do is get us started with a framework that allows us to focus in on these issues here. And I need to arbitrarily cut it off at this point because we need to, I've got the calendar.
We're
going to
tell you exactly how you make these decisions. Yeah. Very easily.
Pre-programmed to come up with the right answer. All right.
I do think, at home on my bedside table is a fabulous book just came out last year called Healing by the Heart. It's about case studies, very thick, very thorough, case studies of the Hmong in St. Paul coming into contact with our medical system. So it's illustrative of a number of immigrant populations, but it's particular about the Hmong, where the reason we're giving you this, again, we have a week, but this is our framework in the United States of the majority medical culture, and it's being tested every day, probably at your workplaces, not many of you in healthcare. But this will make it all easy. Some of you, I'm sure, heard Marilyn in her spiritual direction. Isn't Marilyn spiritual direction? Madeline. Sorry, Madeline, are you here? So Madeline gave us a lovely sort of step-by-step way of doing Lectio Divina, a lovely spiritual discipline for prayer. I'll say something about step-by-step things, which is that it's useful for most of us to think about this in steps. We like this particular model, but if you read in medical ethics at all, some books have 11 steps, some books have 3 steps, people write dissertations on why there should be 7.5 steps, I'm sort of kidding, but the point is this isn't the only way. We have just found it very useful in our teaching and I in my practice, and probably you in your practice as well, a little bit in Montana with the hospital. This isn't about a cookbook for how to do it right. It's one way to think about carefully and reasonably thinking through an ethical decision.
Could I mention just a couple things about to go into this, and then Mary will walk us through this. I teach philosophical ethics, and so we spend a lot of time there looking at what different philosophers have said. Some of you, for example, may have read Immanuel Kant, and that brings up painful memories. I apologize, but I have my students wading through Immanuel Kant, who's just a brilliant ethicist. But Immanuel Kant really believed there were absolute moral principles that applied regardless of the circumstances and situation. And so discerning the right principles and living those out was a really critical thing. I mentioned John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill was a different branch of ethics, one that we call utilitarianism, but more broadly, consequentialism. In that branch, it says, no, you don't focus so much on the principles regarding the situation. You focus on the likely consequences. You want to make good consequences come out of our decisions there. And so you focus on that is what tells you whether it's right or wrong. Mary and I are working with a model that says both of those are important. That we believe it's important to have guidance by principles, but principles aren't necessarily absolute in all situations. It's also really important to pay attention to consequences so that we don't inadvertently bring about bad consequences. But there may be situations where standing up for principle is more important than thinking about consequences. But we're going to introduce a model here that tries to bring in both of these and then have us put the mix together.
The social work has a code of ethics, as do many professions, and I love it. In the intro, it says something about reasonable differences can and do occur among social workers relative to this code of ethics. And one time I went through and highlighted in yellow everything I thought was consequentialist-based and everything I thought was principles-based in pink, and it was sort of both all the way through. So that's the reality we're living with. Otherwise, why should we be here? If it was clear, you wouldn't need to be here. You could be hiking. This model is thanks to Dr. Ron Hamill, who some of you may know, anybody from Chicago area. Last I heard, about 3-4 years ago, he was a hospital ethicist at Lutheran General, and he's taught at the Park Ridge Center for Ethics. He's fabulous. He used to be in the Twin Cities, so I got to learn this directly from him. I think he's probably adapting it over time, as we have a little bit as well, which we mentioned. I'm just going to talk about the first three briefly, and Dan, the second three. Initially, the first three steps are how to analyze what you're dealing with, and the last is how to think about the morality of the situation. So let me just briefly say what those are. First, in a specific situation, which we'll get to at the end of today and through the week, is what are the relevant facts and information? Again, income isn't relevant in some situations. What do we have to know in order to decide something in this particular situation?
If I mention just a word here, right? This is what I mentioned before, preventing a moral tragedy is one of your starting points there. And that means you really have to be informed, because if you're missing a critical piece of information that you could have had, my teacher, Larry Rasmussen, had the image that ethics is like watching the dark room and turning on the light. It should shed light on the situation so that you can at least start from an informed stance.
And that has to do with saying, who are the sources of information in this situation? Who knows something that we, the decision makers, whoever we decide they are, need to know? And what backgrounds and perspectives do they represent? I also like to say to my students, it's easy to get stuck right here. Say, well, I need to know more. No, but tell me more. And during our case studies, we'll say, but what about, we need to know this. Tell us, Mary, what else? It's easy to get there, but you know what? In real life, we can never know it all, can we? People's stories are too complicated. So we do our best to gather what we really need to know to move on. Secondly, we have to say, is the issue we're addressing truly an ethical concern or an ethical problem? In medical ethics, we often at the hospital end up saying, you know, this really isn't an ethical question. It's really that that patient didn't understand what the doctor was telling her in the family conference. We need to clarify the communication and the information, and then there's not a dilemma. So we need to be clear that it really is an ethical issue or dilemma. And we've defined dilemma for you over here as a situation when ethical values or principles or actions in a certain situation conflict. That's what we're mostly about this week. Sometimes it's clear as a bell what should be done, what we ought to do. We're talking about the times when we don't know. It's either this or this. Both could be done. Both could be argued to be ethical. How do we determine which is the route to take? The other thing I'd like to say is, you know, it's an ethical dilemma, even if after you've made a decision and it's behind you, it still sits in your gut. Then you know it was a dilemma, because it's not generally clear. That's why we have to struggle, okay? Thirdly, we generate alternatives and possible consequences of each of those. And here's where we say, be as creative and as wild as possible. Not only do we say, doing nothing is an alternative, because that's a decision, isn't it? To do nothing, take no action is to make a decision. But also, think wildly. Well, what if we decided this or this? But within that, say, who would that affect and how? In the short term and in the long term, and in negative ways and in positive ways. So this is a very big step. And it's kind of fun to just sit with a sheet of paper and say, what if we did this? Then what would happen? Oh, what if we did this? What could happen? To whom? And after what period of time might something like that happen? And consider all the possible actors who will be affected by the decision we make. So that's a place to get very creative. And again, we're doing this today and this week because we have time. We have time to sit back and chew on a lot of this and think about it and get some practice in.
That's great. Now, I'll just say a couple words, then we want to leave you with a case to ruminate. That was a wonderful word that Madeline brought up. Get in our rooms and cogitate on it. One thing we may not have mentioned before, ethics is so interesting but so challenging because in many ways it operates like law. It operates by precedence. You resolve a case and it becomes especially embedded in policy and it sets the consequences for the future. So it's this third step of generating alternatives and consequences is really critical. It also sometimes goes so much against the grain of who we are as a can-do people in this country. We like to get right to the answer. Europeans have no problem. They open another bottle of wine and just keep talking.
Don't leave saying, Mary and Dan say, what we should do is open a bottle of wine and keep talking.
Just keep going. All right. The first three steps are really just analyzing the situation, turning the light on the situation. But then we do have to get to the moral assessment, weighing where these things seem. And so what we try to do in step four is combine steps two and three. We try to take a look at the different alternatives and their likely consequences and assess them in light of the relevant values and principles. If we do this, do we avoid harming anybody? If we do this, are we really promoting the well-being or is it promoting my reputation as a surgeon? I mean, you think about the these different things and you assess them in light of the relevant ethical values and principles. This all sounds very abstract now, but we'll be working through the cases to get a chance to practice it. And we'll talk about it here. So this is where you really begin to assess the different possibilities. Now, for many folks, this would be a point where you would just make a choice and then justify it. But there's one really critical step in between, and that's in the step number five, to assess underlying motives in light of these relevant values and principles. The very, very same physical action can be either ethical or unethical, depending on what's the motive for it. I pulled the plug on Grandma because she told me in her advance directive that she would never want to live in this situation. I pulled the brag on Grandma because I found out this morning that I'm the main person in her will. Very same physical action. We would judge one as ethical, one unethical. So assessing motive really can be a critical one for shedding some light in there as well. And not always easy to do because things get mixed up. But the final step here, although Mary will maybe add a separate one, is to finally then, once we've done all this, to choose an alternative. But then to justify that choice. And what I say to my students is, how do you justify it to those who would disagree with you? Why do you say this alternative is better than the other ones you consider? So you're making a choice, but then you're explaining why you think it's the best of these choices, these options you've got. And then we always encourage people to revisit these situations as you live with them over time.
Particularly, I think that's important for professionals who are dealing with this regularly, to go back a week later, a month later, even a year later, when it's still sitting here, and say, okay, that we've done that, and the person is dealt with. Would we do it the same this time, if we're faced with a similar situation? If so, why? If not, why not? And make an argument for what we did, to always look back and reflect so we always learn, because these are not so clear. Okay, well, we didn't think we'd have quite this many people, and so my guess is that we have to have three people share a case study. We brought 40. So, if you know and like three people, or you can meet two other people you haven't met, even better. So we want you to take this with you, and whether you come back again ever with us, here's a case for you to work through tonight over.
We're going to read it through.
Okay, we got time.
And we do have a few, if there are people who are, like us, increasingly visually challenged, we do have three large print ones. If there's anybody who needs a large print.
Here's
If we missed anybody who would like a large print, tell us and we'll get it to you, please.
We do get some print here. So I'm going to have Mary read this case, and we're going to close on it, but we're going to start tomorrow considering this case. So we'd like you to think about it. We'll use it to work through this case there and then go to physician-assisted suicide.
Okay, so if you can't see it, listen. Do as we're told. Some of us.
We did.
Yes.
They did what?
They got some upstairs.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you. Okay, this is called, quote, "God and My Children Will Know What's Best." Anna is a 61-year-old woman who's widowed. She's in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease to the point where she no longer speaks, walks, feeds herself, or recognizes her family. She's lived in a nursing home for 4.5 years. She has a history of a repaired hip fracture and some bleeding, which the physician thinks is an indication of cancer. She's currently diagnosed with pneumonia, which if not treated through antibiotics intravenously, will result in her death. She has no living will, commonly called advanced directives now, we're trying not to use living will, and when pressed earlier by her 5 children about what her wishes would be for treatment at the end of life, she responded, "God and my children will know what's best for me." She's a Lutheran pastor's wife and a woman of deep faith. The five children are given the choice of whether to hospitalize Anna for IV antibiotics or not. If treated, the pneumonia would probably clear up, though the doctor has said it's likely to recur again and again, probably ending her life within a matter of months because she's at the end stage of Alzheimer's. If untreated, Anna would likely die within a week. One of Anna's children is your best friend and asks your advice. What do you say to help your friend help this family make this decision? Yeah, question?
Can I just put something out to talk
about? Nope. Oh, to talk about? You can't put out what you would do, because what we're going to get you, we hope, to do by the end of the week is not just say, well, I would just tell her to do this. I would just say, do this. Or don't do this. What we want you to do is think through. What do you need to know here? And why? And what do you think about? So did that just stop your comment? Sorry. So we will start tomorrow with this. But if you can't come back tomorrow and want to talk with either Dan or me about this case, we'll be happy to discuss it individually, or you chat about it because lots of you have similar situations.